The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
From Radio America and the American Veterans Center, this is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators recall and retell their personal stories, serving our nation in times of war. And now, Veterans Chronicles.
Despite their long history of service in the United States military, prior to the Second World War, African Americans were usually segregated from their white countrymen or relegated to performing mundane tasks. However, with the outbreak of World War II and the prospect of total war, the military experienced a desperate need for manpower. Long before General Eisenhower allowed blacks to join their white counterparts on the battlefield, the U.S. Navy went ahead with the experiment to integrate black crews with white officers aboard two ships, one of which was the USS Mason. Lorenzo Dufoe was one of the 150 black men who served with that historic crew on the Mason. The New Orleans native was driven by a call to defend his homeland after Pearl Harbor, and when the Navy granted African Americans access, he quickly enlisted. In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, Dr. Lewis Sorley sits down with Dufoe to discuss life aboard the Mason and the challenges faced by the pioneering crew. Dufoe's story begins in New Orleans, where he was born and raised in the years leading up to the war.
I was born in 1920. In New Orleans, Louisiana, and I was one of three children. I grew up in New Orleans and married at an early age, 19 years old, and I was the father of one child at that time in 1941 when I was coming from work one Sunday evening. From people's radio, I can hear it out on the sidewalk, mentioning Pearl Harbor. I had never heard of Pearl Harbor before, not in New Orleans. And when I got home, the wife was telling me what had happened. So I listened and was quite upset about what had happened and how tragic it was. And at that time, the service was segregated.
Yes.
Very much so. But I was upset about the Navy being attacked the way it happened. And I felt so... I just wanted to know what in the world I could do to be of help to defend home, because with all the warts and rocks and everything, America is still home to me. I was born here.
Yes.
And when the situation was so bad, there was a movement to try to integrate the Navy to allow us to have rates other than stewards, mates, and cooks.
Yes.
And manpower was needed at that time, so it was a good time for politics at that time. And finally, in June of 42, the doors were open, and I volunteered to go into the services, into the Navy, because I felt I wanted to help defend home. I had this wife and kid.
Yes.
And I was a little depressed at that time also because we had lost one child at birth. But I wanted to get out of that rut that I was in and be effective in helping defend home. And at 22 years old, in June of 42, I enlisted. The officer who signed me up, he knew my family personally, and he asked me, say, you know, you don't have to go in the service. You're 3A, and you don't have to go. I said, but this is something I want to do. I would feel better being a part of opening the doors for my son and others to come after. And it may sound corny at times when you say about being an American citizen and boasting about it, but I am an American citizen, always will be. But I was concerned about the attack, the way it was brought about, and the damage that was done. But I didn't want to sit home. I wanted to be a part of that integration movement. I said I would help open doors for future generations, especially my son, and prove that we were as much American as anybody.
Yes.
Because being an American is not a race, it's a way of life. And anybody, any nationality, you can be an American citizen. And I wanted to be a part of that program that opened the doors for my son and others to really be a part of the fighting forces without any limitations. And I went in June of 42. I was sent to Great Lakes, Illinois.
Yes.
At a boot camp. And we had, it was quite an interesting thing. Quite not interesting. It was kind of miserable at the time because I had to sleep in a hammock, which I had never slept in.
Not easy thing to do.
I was away from home and had to get accustomed to that revelry. I used to want to choke that guy who wake up so early in the morning with all that noise.
You had plenty of company in that.
Oh, my goodness. But once we got accustomed to it, we got into that routine of revelry and trotting all over the place. But I knew the main thing was to prove my ability to adapt to training. And we had there's a test, a general classification test they give you.
Yes.
And I was selected to go to Signalman School. And they went to classes at Great Lakes. And in January of 43, I was in the first class to graduate at Great Lakes under that new program. And I was a third class signalman. And I was sent to New York City. And during the war, the Navy put a signal crew aboard this Coast Guard vessel.
Mm-hmm.
But it put a signal crew aboard. It was about four men, about six men on each tour that had to check all the ships in and out of New York Harbor. And we had to relay it over to Sandy Hook. There was a receiving signal station over there. By signal light, we relay.
Mm-hmm.
The identification, the flag, the numbers connected with the ships. And they would relay it to 90 Church Street. That's the third district. That was headquarters. And they knew the movement of every ship along the coast. So for about 9 months, we had experience on there. And then one day, I was transferred from there. I was told I was going to be trained to go aboard the destroyer escort. And they sent me to Virginia, where we had a school down there, especially for DE training. And I went through a series of classes and learned the Morse code and how to send and receive by flags and blinking light. And it was quite interesting that I was eventually chosen to be aboard the ship, the USS Mason, and the crew was assembled in Boston, Massachusetts, just before it was commissioned. And we had some serious classes up there preparing to go aboard. And we were the first men to go aboard when they launched it. It was ice in the harbor. And the day that it was commissioned, we had to go aboard, and ice was in the harbor, packed up around that ship, and there was no heat aboard that ship. I slept with my dress blues.
And here you are from New Orleans, right?
Socks.
Yeah.
And I had my socks on, and I had a blue jacket on with the sweater, and the two blankets, all that covered, and the watch cap. I slept the first night aboard the Mason. And everybody, it was so cold. And the officers saying there's nothing they could do about it. That's what the Navy wanted. Well, you can't buck the Navy rules, you know. But once we got things going on there, we began to adapt to life aboard ship. And eventually we were chosen to do escort work. We made convoys.
Yes.
And that was quite interesting because I didn't know there was so much water on the way. And to wake up to see water and ships and convoy day after day, it can get real boring.
I'll bet.
They can run you up a wall.
Yeah.
But for some reason or another, we were determined to overcome that by, we used to help the stewards clean up the area, and we used to sit in the mess hall and shoot the breeze, you know. That's a lot of yak yak talk. And if they ran us out of there, we go sit on the fantail. That's where all the scuttlebutt comes up.
Okay.
And hear all the lies. And but we had to do that to keep ourselves entertained and involved, because it can get real boring out there.
Now, where were you escorting the convoys to?
We went to the first convoy. We went to Land's End. We released the convoy at Land's End, England, and we went up to Belfast, Ireland, to refuel and pick up food and stuff.
Yeah,
and that was a great experience for us, because we always wondered whenever we went to a new place how the people were going to treat us.
Yes,
and it's always curious about First Liberty Party, who's going to be like the head of the arrow to take the brunt.
Yes,
of what the shock that's going to hit you when you get among the different people.
Yes,
and I was in the First Liberty Party there. And we were set back on our heels the way the people greeted us.
Nicely.
I'm telling you, a lady apologized because the sun wasn't shining.
Ah.
She wanted us to see Ireland with the sunshine.
How nice.
And when we got back to the ship, we just talked, I guess, all night long about how nice the people were, because it's the first place that we went where we were greeted.
Yes.
Here in the States, we sit in the back of the bus or whatever.
Yes, in your own country. Yeah.
And here we go over there, and then people treat us so well. The guy had invited us into the pub. We had stout. And sailors trying to prove how good they can carry that liquor. And them old timers had to put us to shame, you know.
they had a lot of experience.
The guy was straight gin. They would take it down, and they had a glass of stout for a chaser. Now, I couldn't handle the straight gin. I always mix it with soda and everything, but trying to prove a sailor could take it. And that stout, oh my goodness, that was bitter. Oh my goodness. And I'm telling you, I was cross-eyed and nothing flat.
When we return to Veterans Chronicles, Dufault recalls the Masons' convoy missions in the Atlantic.
Veterans Chronicles is now podcasting at RadioAmerica.org. Log on to our website, click on the podcasting icon, and look for Veterans Chronicles. Once there, follow the instructions on your computer to subscribe to our podcast. You'll always find our most recent program on the Veterans Chronicles podcast, in addition to past programs from our archives. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, free and online at RadioAmerica.org. Also available on Apple iTunes.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. In the previous segment, Lorenzo Dufault recounted his journey from his home in New Orleans to his historic deployment aboard the USS Mason. The story picks up as Dufault and his fellow crew members compare how they were treated abroad to how they were treated at home.
The guys were so nice to us. So they just greeted us and treated us so nice.
Yeah.
And when we got back to the ship, we're talking about it, and then the next group of Liberty guys who go on Liberty, they were so anxious. They want to go see where were people treating us that way, because at home it was so bad.
Yes.
And I'm telling you, it was the same thing when the next group went out.
Yeah.
You found out that was just the way the people were.
They were. How long did it take for a convoy to cross the Atlantic usually?
I think the first one that we went, it was about 5 days, 4 or 5 days, something like that. But we had another convoy that we took to Land's End, England, where we released it. But it was just before the invasion of Normandy, they needed tugboats and barges to rebuild the harbor, because they knew they were going to blow up Normandy for the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to take this convoy of 119, and it consisted of tugboats pulling barges.
This must have taken forever.
I've done it 5 knots with the top speed.
Oh, my goodness.
5 knots. You can walk that fast. And day after day, here we trudging across that ocean, zigzagging in front of the convoy. It was five escorts.
Yes.
We had the convoy boxed in.
Hmm.
And you see the tugs just creeping, creeping, creeping. And I'm telling you, it was enough. You can see why some people can go nuts out there. And then when you get out there, you see nothing but water and maybe the sun or the moon or stars and ships. And you're just stuck with that same scene day after day.
Yes.
And your shipmates, you see them day after day, that close quarters. And you have to be so careful because some guys, some days, they're in a bad mood. They're launching from home or...
Yeah.
Maybe they receive a bad letter or something like that. And you had to be sensitive to the mood that this guy's in.
Yes.
By the way you speak the first few minutes, whether you say good morning or hi or what, something, if you don't respond, you have to respect that.
Yeah.
And we pass word, you know, lay off, leave him alone, give him time to come out of it, you know.
Yeah, on any of these crossings, did you experience enemy action against the convoys?
I cannot admit, we never had an identity of a hit, but we had to make runs on what we assumed was subs.
Yeah.
But we never have identification of active like debris. But one time we was coming from Oran, North Africa, and we did a run on a target. And it wound up being a derelict barge. And somebody was doing some figuring and calculation. They figured it may have been one of the barges that we lost from the convoy sometime earlier.
Made its way all the way down there.
At the speed that the tide was traveling, it could have been one of them.
Hmm.
But there was no evidence exactly, but it damaged. We lost our sound gear, and we had to travel. We had to run ahead of the convoy without sound gear. We stopped in Bermuda to check the hull. Then they let us go to Charleston, where they had to do the repair work. They didn't do the repair work in Charleston. They did the repair work in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
in Navy Yard Brooklyn. And those guys, we thought we'd be in a dry dock for days. We went in one evening, and the next day we were out.
They worked too fast.
That yard had a reputation of doing the job, you know.
Yes. Did you keep track of how many Atlantic crossings you took part in?
We took five round trips.
Yeah.
And the first trip, we came back just escorts, five vessels. We steamed back without a convoy.
Yes.
But after that, we made a trip to Plymouth, England, and then three trips to Oran, North Africa. And the war ended, and we were sent down to Florida to train young officers. We used to take them out for about a week, five days, to train young officers how to handle the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Because the captain at that time, we had changed captains. And the captain had written to Washington requesting duty in the Pacific. And that was an issue that we were teased. We knew how to handle the ship, but that second captain wasn't the kind of guy we felt could be our leader.
Uh-huh.
Because he never did learn how to con that ship, con and how to give orders, how to maneuver and all.
Uh-huh.
But the executive officer was good at it. But this second captain was kind of stubborn. And we had the feeling that he was there not so much to do the Navy job. We had the feeling that he was there to try to make a reputation for himself,
mm-hmm.
like being another Abe Lincoln.
Yeah.
And so we didn't want to be no casualties to somebody on an ego trip.
No.
So... we didn't feel good about going with that captain.
Yes.
Because we didn't have the confidence in him.
After the break, Dufault concludes his story by talking about life after the war. Stay tuned.
This is the Radio America Network.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We remember 24 hours a day.
We study the news and history.
We assemble information. We speak out.
And we listen to you.
And we don't forget that every pleasant minute of this freedom we owe to those who defend it.
So, here's to life.
The freedom of conscience.
And liberty.
Thank God Almighty!
And the pursuit of happiness.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. Lorenzo Dufault and the crew of the USS Mason fought to prove that black men could excel as sailors in the United States Navy. Despite their efforts in the war, however, Dufault was still met with racial prejudice upon his return home. Despite hardship, Dufault found purpose in his life by spreading the story of the crew of the USS Mason to as many people as he could. The story picks up again with the fate of the Mason after the war.
After the war was over, did the Mason stay in service?
No. They took it out of service. It was sold for scrap metal. I think it was in 47.
Yes.
It was cut up for scrap.
Did you get a piece of it?
No. After I got out of the service, I didn't want nothing to do with Navy anymore because we had gone through so much hell.
Yes.
Imagine what we were going through. We were trying to do a job, and we did the job. But to do it against such odds that we were defending a system that didn't permit us to enjoy the benefits of the system.
Yeah.
Because so many places you couldn't even vote.
Yes.
Or you had to ride in the back of the bus or whatever section it is, and some places you didn't have the service.
Yes.
It was just terrible. And I was in uniform coming back off my 9-day leave, passing through Atlanta. I was on the train from New Orleans to Chicago. And the train stopped in Atlanta, and I got off to try to get a sandwich at the lunch counter. And I asked for a cup of coffee. And they said, "You don't have any." I said, "Coffee? That stuff in that urn, that big urn, the steam urn." And she said, "We don't have any." Then I got the message.
Mm.
And that thing really was like a spear in me, you know.
Of course,
and being denied coffee at a counter like that.
Mm.
But that didn't stop me from learning my job well and doing my job, because we knew we were under the microscope.
Yes.
We knew that. But the very first convoy, there was a gold braid from Washington, made the convoy his job was just to observe.
See how he did.
Bring a report back to Washington how we handled it.
Yes.
And we did a good job. But it was just such a terrible experience to say, "Now, you give me a job, you trust me to do it."
Did the crew of the Mason have reunions later?
No. We didn't come together until years later. My friend James Graham, who lived out in Roosevelt, Long Island, he made an effort to get us together. We formed the Mason Association with the idea of bringing it together. But the best experience in as far as shipmates coming together, when this lady did the story about our ship, Mary Pat, when she did the story, the Irish Tourist Board sponsored a trip to Ireland for 1 week. We left International Airport on one Sunday and came back the next Sunday. And I think the whole week, we only spent money for two meals. And, you know, we were sailors, we didn't have much money anyway, but this is civilian life now. But it was quite a treat.
I'll bet.
The way we were treated.
I'll bet.
After all those years, we went back and was greeted and treated just swell.
Yeah.
The Lord Mayor of Ireland, Belfast, put on a banquet for us. Oh, it was really fantastic.
Yeah.
See, after all those years, that people still treat it as great. You're genuine people, you know.
What did you do after the Navy, sir?
I pushed a cart around the garments district in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Because it was no work, no job for me, because I was a signalman aboard ship in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
But there was no job for me in civilian life that could match up
I see.
My skills, you know.
Yes.
And so having a wife and kid, I had to get work. So the I think it was about $35 a week to be pushing that cart around. The garment district guys used to make skirts and different things. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting. Like the whole industry used to be down in Lower Manhattan.
We remember that.
And you're going to walk around the street and you see signs hanging on for workers, you know. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't much money. But I had to do something because I couldn't make it just waiting for another $20 a week from the compensation, you know.
Right.
And I stayed with that, and eventually I drove a cab for a while. Mm-hmm. And guys stuck me up one night, and they chased me out of the cab.
Well, I don't blame you.
I was in a war, and nobody drew a gun on me. I come driving a taxi in New York, and the guy draw a gun on me. That scared the daylights out of me. But I eventually... somebody took me to a construction job. They were hiring. They had been on strike. And so when they got over the strike, they were hiring. And I went into working in the construction. And I think it was about 1954. And I stayed in there. Those workers up and down, seasonal sometimes. But I'm still there. I collect pension from the union because I stayed in it. 50 cents. Well, I've been in there something like 56, 57 years.
Wow.
But I didn't work all those years. I was in and out, because of the up and down thing about the economy. But that was my main source of income.
Yes.
And I have the pleasure of knowing when I ride around New York City, I can see so many buildings I worked
on. That you were part of.
And it just feels good, you know, that I'm not...
Sense of
I always enjoyed being a part of something constructive, you know,
yes.
Building, making things better because I was there.
Yes.
Being a part of that.
Yes.
That's so important to me.
Yes.
And I still practice that. If I can't help, I'm not going to harm.
Good.
And my conscience is clear. I sleep yes. good at night.
Yes.
I don't need to drink a pint of whiskey to go to sleep. And I don't need no medication to go to sleep. I'm on medication, but that's for a heart problem I had in 81. I still have it, but I'm on medication. I don't have no complaint. My doctor told me, I saw about 3 or 4 months ago, the last time. She said, don't come back unless you have a complaint. And I haven't seen her since. But I stay on the medication, you know.
Yes.
I'm very lucky, very fortunate. I think my mission is to spread the word on the Mason. I think I have the power that be has gotten me out here spreading the word that about our story. I hope someday that it become a part of American history taught in all the schools.
Yeah.
So the young people can see how important it is to be a part of society, contributing to making society better.
Yes.
Because we got one of the greatest treasures, our freedom. We have it here.
Yes.
And we have to preserve it. But I wouldn't be satisfied sitting back like other people do it for me. I want to be a part of it. And I try to encourage the youngsters, whatever job you do, do it well. It is a waste of time if you're on a job and just goofing around. You're wasting time, and you make a bad reputation for yourself.
Right.
And one of the best things somebody can say about you, you say, well, what about that guy as a laborer? You say, he's a good man. And that's one of the biggest compliments.
Absolutely right.
I had a labor foreman. He was a mean little rascal. But he told me right up to my face, he said, I don't have nothing against you about your work. He said, but personally, I hate your guts. I said, well, I love you. Oh, he threw his hat on the ground and stomped him. He said, get out of here. I said, if you're paying me off, give me my money. He said, go to the office and get your money. And I went up to the office and I told the bosses about it. And there was two guys. And they said, go sit outside the bar. We'll talk. We'll figure something for you. And when they did call me back in, they sent me on a job it was like a four-month vacation with pay. Because in construction work, they had what you call patch-up work.
Yeah.
And that means you may have had one or two bricklayers to finish up work before you get paid this last money. And they used to call me up at home, tell me go to such and such a place, and I'm going to meet a bricklayer and such and such thing. I was able to go and get things done, and they get the last payment. And I enjoyed that work. And eventually, the guy got to be more controlling of the workforce, and they wanted kickback. They got caught up in that. They got kicked out. But at that time, I got caught up with them. The guy was telling me all I had to do was borrow money from the foreman, and he was going to be Sherlock. And I said, I'm going to work hard with this money, and let the guy Sherlock me too? I said, no, indeed. So I went to the union, and they sent me on jobs, and I was able to do pretty good, and I was doing good. And I got to work with a general contractor, and the guy sent me to work at a building, number one Broadway. It's some type of historic building, the number one Broadway. And he had me as foreman. I said, good grief, what a move. But then the guy who was superintendent of construction, he was heavy on the bottle. And he used to give me a hard time trying to cover him up because he'd make mistakes or he'd forget to get certain work. He couldn't coordinate the workers, the different trades coming in. He couldn't coordinate them. He was creating a lot of problems. I was going out of my way to try to protect him because I was given a chance to do a good job.
Sure.
And I collapsed under all the strain and pressure because in 1981 I collapsed at home. And that took me out of the workforce. But my reputation, it was good. And I managed to hold things together. But I got good medical care. But then so many things happened that I thought I would outlive my children, but all my children are lost. I had adult children. Right now I have about 8 grand and about 17 great lands.
Oh,
they're
boy.
My treasures.
Really?
They are my treasures.
Oh, I guess.
But I never thought I would outlive my children, man.
No.
Son and 2 daughters I lost. And I lost them in a matter of about 3 or 4 years.
Huh.
But I don't grieve over them because I dream about them a lot.
They've left you all these treasures, though.
And I go visit them for a few days, then I come back. Because there's most of them around in Georgia, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But I never leave New York unless I have a round trip ticket. The kids are so active, and I don't kid myself. I cannot deal with being around children continuously day after day. Mm-hmm. They have to have their space.
Yeah.
And there's some things that the parents put up with, I wouldn't tolerate.
Yes.
But I don't interfere. I love them all. They're my grands and great-grands. And I keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
I ain't let them hurt themselves or nothing, but the decision between parent and child, I let them work it out. That's their
better
growing
do.
Up, you know.
Sir, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you. You tell your story extremely well. Congratulations on your service. We've been talking with Lorenzo Dufo, a United States Navy veteran of World War II. Thank you, sir. This is Louis Sorley for Veterans Chronicles.
Coming up in our final segment is this week's Profile in Valor. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.